programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KABU Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in to KABU March 8th for a 24-hour celebration of women through music, cultural, and public affairs programming in honor of International Women's Day. From 5:30 a.m. on March 8th to 5:30 a.m. the next day, KABU will continue our annual tradition of celebrating the achievements of women, as well as pushing for parity, recognition, equity, and equality for women and women-identified folks in our community and in our world. The schedule for the March 8th 24-hour celebration of International Women's Day is posted at kboo.fm/iwd2018.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying her habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Today, we welcome Matt Roselle to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland with your host, Courtney Scott. Matt Roselle has a long history as an animal activist, starting with undercover work for factory farm and fur-bearing animals, then as a lab tech at Oregon National Primate Research Center. His undercover video exposed the harsh reality of life for lab monkeys. Later, he was Northwest Director in Defense of Animals, where among his many causes, he advocated for the elephants at the Oregon Zoo. And then he moved on to Animal Defenders International, which helps to rescue wild animals, including lions, from circuses in Bolivia. And at present, he is working for the Beagle Freedom Project. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, we're so glad you could make it today. So, you know, you've gone through a lot in your career. It's amazing the variety of jobs you've had working for animals. It's just amazing diversity there.
Well, it's been a real privilege, and especially I feel like the work undercover has been a privilege to be able to actually really see what's happening behind the scenes and meet these individuals and be able to tell their stories and hopefully use those stories and them as ambassadors to help make changes for the ones that are still suffering.
Yes, I think the undercover work is definitely probably the most crucial part a lot of times for people to really understand, as it was for me when I saw your video of the primates at the Oregon National Primate Center. I didn't know until I saw that video. So I think it's really opening a lot of people's eyes. So tell us now you're working for the Beagle Freedom Project. What is your position there? And tell us more about the Beagle Freedom Project.
Yeah, well, I'm really excited to be Beagle Freedom Project's campaign and policy director. And the Beagle Freedom Project, we're based here out of the Los Angeles area, but we're rescuing animals from research across the country and also working towards the day where no animals will be locked away in labs and being used for invasive experiments. Beagle Freedom Project started almost exactly 7 years ago, December 23rd of 2010. Shannon Keith, who is the founder and president of the organization, she was able to organize a rescue of two beagles from a medical testing lab. And these two beagles were so scared, and it took about 20 minutes for them to even get out of the cages. They had never known a life outside of cages, had never known love, felt fresh air, seen the open sky, had never walked on grass. And then within minutes after they finally had the courage to come out of those crates, they were running around and playing, and it was the most heartwarming scene. And since then, Beagle Freedom Project has been able to rescue hundreds of animals, not just beagles, but other animals, goats, rabbits, mice, rats, cats, and horses, and found them homes and given them a life after labs. And I think on that first day 7 years ago, Shannon made a decision. She realized that a lot of people just have no idea what's going on in labs, that they don't even know that dogs and cats, monkeys and other animals are locked away in these places being tested on and killed for things as meaningless as purporting to study illicit drugs or just being used to be tested on for cosmetics or products. And so she has made it her life mission, and I'm helping her and all the other great, wonderful people we're working with here, and all the volunteers here at Beagle Freedom Project are working on that mission.
Wow, that's a really big mission. So I noticed on the Beagle Freedom website, it says there are 383 labs in the U.S. that use nearly 70,000 dogs every year, of which 96% are beagles. That's an incredible number. Why do you think there's so many of them are beagles?
Well, it's unfortunate for them that their docile, friendly, forgiving nature is the exact reason why they're both, you know, the fifth most popular dog for people to have in their homes and the number one most popular dog for research animals. They, you know, no matter what you do to them, they are forgiving and don't resist and don't bite, and it's why they're used. And also just their size, they're a smaller breed of dog that fits well in a cage. A lot, as you know, a lot of animal research is really about the money, and it's about efficiency, and they're run like an assembly line is what I experience inside of the research labs. These labs are really about making money and about continuing a type of research that there are so many vested interests, from the pharmaceutical companies to the researchers themselves and all the companies that supply the products and cages and everything and the animals for testing, all have an interest in keeping this going. And the beagles happen to fit in that formula well because they're a small-sized dog. It's easier to keep them than some other.
Yeah, I that makes sense. And, you know, I had a beagle when I was a kid, and she was very docile and sweet, though she was an escape artist. I have to mention that.
Yeah. They do follow their nose. I had a beagle in my life for a while, too, and his name was Buddy. We had to buddy-proof the fence many times.
Amazing how they figure ways out, though, isn't it?
Well, in fact, all of the rescues that we work with, the beagles that we rescue, we equip them with a GPS collar because... For that exact reason. We don't want to lose track of these precious animals, so we make sure that we can keep track of them.
That's funny. That's one of their traits, I guess. That means they're breeding these animals too, right? They're not just getting them from, like, pet stores and shelters. They actually breed them. Is that correct?
Right. And the number one supplier of beagles, ferrets, and other animals in the U.S. is a company called Marshall Bioresources, and also previously known as Marshall Farms in New York. And to the tune of you know, hundreds of thousands of animals a year, they're operating, you know, very much like you would think of like a puppy mill. You know, they have massive barns after barn after barn of animals being raised in cages and just cranking out puppies and other animals to be sold.
Right, for research,
to be used in research.
And what happens to the ones that don't get, you know, whatever, they don't make it to someplace? They euthanize quite a number of them, I imagine.
Well, the unfortunate thing about animals used in research is that at the end of the experiment, the animal almost always is killed. And this is true whether or not the animals are healthy or adoptable, or whether they need to use them, or they purport to need to use them and euthanize them for the experiment. And that is, because of that, one of our projects that we've been working on is legislation called the Beagle Freedom Bill. And this is a compassionate, very common sense, bipartisan, simple bill that is just pointing out this need in the law, that this void in the law, that there's various rules and federal regulations that these labs do have to follow to a certain extent, certainly not strong enough laws, but there are laws in place that are put in place to protect these animals right up until the end of the experiment. But there's nothing that in the law that says anything about what happens to them once the experiment is over.
Hmm.
And so this bill is filling that void and is simply saying, if the animal is adoptable, if it's healthy, then you need to find a suitable rescue or shelter to offer that animal for adoption. And we're talking specifically in this bill about dogs and cats. And it has now passed in 6 states, and we have close to a dozen other states that have either introduced it or are actively working on passing the bill and discussing the bill right now. And this is a very middle ground, sort of common ground type of law that doesn't really do anything to affect the research in any way, but it's at a place where everyone should agree.
Right.
These animals deserve to have a life after labs, if at all possible.
Right. Well, I imagine it will affect their research. I mean, that's not the goal, perhaps, but it's going to be making it a lot more cumbersome for them to have so many animals if they have to find homes for them, wouldn't you think?
Well, so basically what the bill does is it doesn't cost anything to the labs, and in fact it takes the burden of the homes off of them.
I see.
Where there are some universities and labs that may already have some kind of a policy in place for adopting out animals, and what we find is that usually it's just a few animals here and there, and they usually are just animals that get adopted out to friends and family of people working in the lab. What this does is it takes the burden off the lab and puts it on the shoulders of the professional rescue community that's very well versed in, handling situations where these dogs do have some rehabilitation issues. They're not potty trained. They've never been on a couch. They don't know. It's basically, no matter what age these dogs are, they're puppies mentally, in terms of like the training that needs to go into them to make them
sure.
a part of someone's family.
Well, it sounds like a win-win situation then, that we should get support from the research facilities, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. And there has been pushback. The universities do often come in and try to make arguments against the bill, but at the end of the day, since 2014 this bill has passed in 6 states, and there has been we've heard nothing but positive things.
Oh, that's great.
No bad fallout. All the fears that some of these universities have about repercussions just have not amounted to anything. And so
great.
It is a win-win, and we're really going to continue to push this bill because we want to see every possible animal come out of those labs and find a happy home.
Well, I hope a lot of them can come out of Oregon National Primate Research Center. So I know they also use beagles there, right?
Yes, there are dogs and cats that are used at OHSU.
So let's hope this moves on to Oregon. I'm sure you have something in the works.
Right? Well, maybe we can work with you on it.
Yeah.
I put my foot in that one. about Oregon, but it's certainly a possibility.
I think it would be a very good place because supposedly, at least, Portland is supposed to be one of the most dog-friendly cities in the country. So you would think you would have a natural constituency here for that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So we're going to take just a very short break right now for station ID, and then we'll be right back. So I just want to say that stay tuned to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. We're going to just take this, well, actually, we're not going to take a break. I want to continue talking to Matt Rozell here. He's got so much to say. So, Matt, thanks so again for joining us on KBOO Portland. You know, you mentioned the thing about dogs, and I keep remembering what Dr. Greek said, that you could kill 1,000 dogs and it wouldn't cure anything, wouldn't save your child's life. So why do you think this idea of research at all, and in your case, especially on these poor little innocent beagles, is going to do anything to save anyone's life?
Yeah, well, I think that there's no doubt the scientific argument against animal research is as old as animal research. And this is, you know, throwing ethics and morals aside for a moment and just looking at, does this actually work? And the problem with using any species, dogs, cats, monkeys, mice, as a model for human disease boils down to the fact that no matter what drug you're testing, what product you're testing, or whatever, it's going to react differently in every single species. And over time, we have a history of drugs that have failed to predict in the animals the similar outcomes to how they are happen when you finally do get to the human clinical trials. And so we've seen drugs that looked safe in animals that went on to harm and kill people in clinical trials and had to be pulled. And the opposite of that are medical breakthroughs have been delayed by misleading animal research that did not look promising in the animal, but then later were tried again in people and went on to help people. So, you know, this, according to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, there's made a statement that, quote, 9 out of 10 experimental drugs fail in clinical studies because we cannot accurately predict how they will behave in people based on laboratory and animal studies.
Wow, that's a huge figure, 9 out of 10.
Yeah, and so what the researchers will argue is it's unethical. We have to do the tests in a living animal before we go on to test it in human beings. Well, the scientific argument against that statement is that, as you quoted Dr. Greek saying, it doesn't matter how many animals you kill, you still do not find out how that drug or that product or that ingredient is going to react in people. And the further medicine advances, the further away we are getting from animal research being a valid form of research. I mean, right now we're looking at, I mean, we already have many alternatives that are already in use. And as Dr. Greek argues, you know, just using the term alternative is a misnomer, because saying alternatives to animal research is implying that animal research is working in the first place and we need to find something different to replace it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we already have in vitro studies, which are test tube studies performed with microorganisms and cells and biological molecules that are isolated outside the body. This is something we've long done. And then from there, we have advanced to computer modeling, which takes all the data that's been collected from those studies and experiments and applies sophisticated computer algorithms to predict outcomes in the human patient. And, you know, we've also introduced robotic technology. The EPA has this robot called TOX-21 that can conduct 1,000 experiments at a time, saving as many animals and as much as $1 million in testing.
Wow.
And so, you know, we now have a thing called organ on a chip, which is a microchip that simulates the functions and physiological responses of organs and organ systems, and epidemiological studies, which analyzes, you know, just vast amounts of data from human patients over time and makes predictions about outcomes with drugs, and microdosing, which is using really small safe doses of drugs in humans to predict outcomes. So we already have all these different tools in our toolbox that are working and can be argued that are better and faster and cheaper than using animals as models. And then there's this whole realm of basic research, which is a lot of what I saw at the Oregon Primate Center, which is funded almost primarily through our tax dollars. And this basic research is not really the product and drug testing that you think of what we just described, like, you know, first testing on animals and then moving on to human studies to specifically try to study a disease in humans or to study a drug and how it will help cure something in humans. Basic research is just this sort of gee whiz kind of science that's just asking questions and publishing data that they hope someday will get used somewhere to help someone. And now we've, for decades, have been doing all these experiments on animals and have all this published data. And I think it's time we take a good hard look at how we're spending these tax dollars and is it really helping people? I mean, some of the research that I saw at the Oregon Primate Center defies common sense. I saw them trying to use, monkeys as a behavior model. They were going to start up a study to use monkeys as a model for human divorce.
Divorce?
Yeah, and of course monkeys don't have.
They don't divorce, do they?
No, they don't. I mean, monkeys are live in matrilinear troops where the males leave anyway. You know, the females all stay together in large troops for life, and the males leave to go join another troop. So they have a completely different makeup and culture, and it's ridiculous to think that you could try to study human divorce in monkeys. But
right.
These are the kind of things they're doing, and maternal deprivation studies are still happening.
Yeah, unbelievable.
All that we know, and a lot of times these researchers are modeling their basic research not to precede human studies, but to try to follow or go in parallel or mimic human studies that already exist. And I think this is a lot of these things people just don't realize. I mean, injecting monkeys with nicotine and cocaine and you know, various drugs are not going to give us results that are going to be beneficial to people.
Right.
And we have plenty of humans already addicted to drugs that we can study that can volunteer for humane studies.
Right. And also I note there was a hearing where a psychologist talked about how they use drugs to measure the effects of bipolar drugs on these primates, and like they don't get bipolar either, I don't believe.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times I saw this really cruel study at the Oregon Primate Center where they were studying multiple sclerosis, and of course the primates don't naturally get that disease, but they were injecting a cocaine derivative into the feet of these monkeys to cripple them in a way that was unlike a naturally occurring disease to try to study.
To simulate it.
Yeah, this is happening over and over again, and I think that if taxpayers really knew what was happening with their money in these research labs that they're funding, they would be outraged.
I agree with you. I think, you know, part of it, from what I understand, is that there's these things are set up. It's like almost like a self-replicating institutional practice where they just have these labs and they have them set up and they just have to go after the grant money to keep the lab going regardless of the efficiency or effectiveness of it.
Yeah, it's very true. The primary investigators are in this environment of publish or perish, and
mm-hmm.
they're focusing on the next grant and keeping it all going. And often these researchers will study some little nuance of science and spend their entire career every time at the end of a study, if you read over these reports that they write and publish, it always says, "We found out this interesting thing, but there's always need for more," and they always go on to study the next little thing. And I think that what we need to do is look and analyze this whole body of research over decades and really take a good hard look at, is this really what our tax dollars are best spent on, or should we be investing that money in better, humane more cutting-edge research that doesn't involve animals.
Exactly. And I note that OHSU, for instance, will periodically say, well, we're on the edge, or we've got a cure for cancer or AIDS or something. And I'm like, what is the cure? I never really know what the cure is. Is there ever really been a cure from animal research?
Well, there's been some really critical pieces written in, you know, over the years about, you know, say, for example, cancer research in mice. And they've kind of come to the conclusion that, you know, on all these years and millions of dollars spent infecting or, you know, like, you know, trying to cure mice of cancer, we sure know a lot about curing cancer in mice, but it hasn't really led to any useful data to cure cancer in people.
Right. And whatever there is really, from what I understand, more based on diet than drugs anyway. But what were you going to say, Matt?
Well, I was just going to say preventative medicine.
Preventative, right, yeah.
I mean, the pharmaceutical companies don't make money on us being well. They make money on us being sick. And
yeah,
that's something, you know, that we all need to step back and look at what choices can we make to our diet and our lifestyle to just prevent disease.
Yeah. And it could be also, I'm just thinking right now, something in the human DNA that's always looking for a magic cure, you know.
Yeah.
And so somewhere over the rainbow, they're going to find that. But anyway, you mentioned that this new law is probably one of the most exciting things you're working on right now. Is there something else that people should know about from the Beagle Freedom Project?
Well, one of the things people can easily do to be a compassionate consumer is to download the Cruelty Cutter app. We have an app. You can go to your on your smartphone and go to your app store and download for free this Cruelty Cutter app that allows you to scan any barcode of any product and immediately find out whether it's cruelty-free or has been tested on animals.
Oh.
And there's a component of it that is a reporting back part that you can let us know that you're boycotting the company, and we can collect that data so we can use it to go to these companies and say, look, you're losing customers here. Why don't you consider not testing on animals? And so that's, you know, that's one simple thing people
mm-hmm.
can do. We're in classrooms. We have a Skype program where we have an educational outreach that's age appropriate, and we're in classrooms all around the world. And one of my colleagues here has a rescued beagle named Belle, and they talk about animal testing in an age appropriate way, and then give the kids opportunities to empower themselves to help animals. And we, of course, are always rescuing animals, which is really the exciting part of this, because our bigger picture goal of ending animal research is going to take a while.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
we're constantly rescuing animals and being able to tell those stories of, you know, putting dogs and cats and other animals in permanent loving homes. And that's really kind of what helps keep all of us going. And,
yeah,
you know, anyone can go on our website and check us out. We're at bfp.org, and you can easily sign up to be receiving our emails. And we're always sending out ways that people can help with our work and volunteer with us.
Great. Well, we're going to put a link to your website on our Voices for the Animals page on KBOO. And any other information that you want us to know about, you can send to me, and I'll also link to that. So,
great.
You know, Matt, thanks so much for joining us today. We're going to have to end right now. But thanks for joining us and enlightening our audience about the work of the Beagle Freedom Project.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. I'll see you soon.
Okay.
Yeah, I also want to mention quickly that Matt will be a featured speaker at the International Free the Elephants Conference in April, right here in Portland. He will be speaking about his experiences working at In Defense of Animals and Animal Defenders International, where he worked for elephant causes, among others. We will be bringing you more news about that conference on our next Voices for the Animals in March. Meantime, thanks to all of you for tuning in to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. You can listen to the podcast of this and all of our programs on KBOO FM. Thanks again to Matt and the very interesting information about the Beagle Freedom Project.
It's time for the news at noon for Monday, February 26, 2018. Today, the Supreme Court made a move to temporarily impede President Trump's September decision to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. The program was scheduled to expire on March 5th. Pressure has mounted on lawmakers to reach a consensus on the status of immigrants, as over 700,000 Dreamers currently remain in a state of legal limbo, with an additional 1 million yet to sign up for the DACA program. Today's decision will temporarily safeguard immigrants who have already enrolled in the program, allowing them to keep working legally in the U.S. for 2 years, and gives the option of renewing their status. As midterm elections near, both parties appear to be taking a cautious approach towards controversial policy decisions just before they face off their constituents in the ballot box. Earlier this month, senators failed to reach a series of votes on a measure backed by Mr. Trump, which would have legalized the family-based migration system but allocated $25 billion for a border wall. The resulting gridlock is likely to push the debate beyond midterm elections in November, with policy debates such as gun law reform taking center stage. In Parkland, Florida, students returned to Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School on Sunday afternoon. It was their first time inside their school since the February 14th shooting, which has since sparked a national debate on gun policy. President Trump has recently called for the arming of school teachers with concealed weapons, furthering the divide between those who advocate for the reduction of gun accessibility and those who believe the increased gun protection is necessary for public safety. According to the Gun Violence Archive, at least 69 kids under the age of 18 have been shot, and 26 of them were killed since the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School less than 2 weeks ago. In international news, the civilian death toll has risen to over 400 in the rebel-held enclave of Eastern Ghouta near the Syrian capital, Damascus. Human rights organizations, as well as the United Nations, have called for a